Spotlights out. Center stage is his easy chair and he sits in the dark. Cut the crap. Cross town, someone shits and it's art. Flip that handicap backwards to parallel park. Between work hard and work harder, hell, even if no one hears any of this, not one letter, he believes writing it has made him feel better. And that only in Scott, hey, that's me, sharing it with strangers, he achieves balance. So if you're gifted in lifting spirits, try and stop robbing the world of your talents. So let's not be strangers after this poem. Every day and night, he chooses to stay home. It isn't always the venue's fault for ending an open mic or closing its doors. It's your own. Uncap your next penaissance. Your work's worth a rebirth. Because if you don't want any more doors to close, you need to open yours first.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you. Well, hello. Welcome to Real Poets. I'm Renzo del Castillo, and with me as always is...
Scatatatatatatat Raven. Where we are real poets. You're a real poet. I'm a real poet. And we sometimes talk to other real poets, but mostly we talk about real poets on film.
We leave them reeling. And maybe our voices are a little bit lowered today because we're talking about A Quiet Passion, the Emily Dickinson biopic. Terrence Davies is a director, came out in 2016. Cynthia Nixon of... Well, she's done many things, but of Sex and the City fame, plays Emily Dickinson.
The new joint? What's the new joint that they have together? The This and Then That? It's kind of the Sex and the City crew.
Yeah. And Just Like That.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Jennifer Ely plays Lavinia Dickinson, or Vinny. I love that actress. She was Elizabeth Bennet in the 90s BBC series of Pride and Prejudice, which had Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy. Amazing. That's one of my favorite adaptations of a novel. And then we have Keith Carradine as their father, Edward Dickinson, as well. What did you think of the movie, Scott? I know you seem to have enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it. I'm going out on a limb as saying I probably like this movie better than I like the like Emily Dickinson. I like this movie as a poetry movie. I think it just really works to the form where the poet is writing in the movie. And like you see so many scenes of writing. So it felt to me that even if it wasn't as true to the poet's life, the expression of the poems were delivered so well in Congress, you know, with kind of the filmmaking, that it worked for me as a poetry film. Just blanket statement as that. I dug. How about you, Renzo?
I did not enjoy this movie.
Our first split.
Yes, our first split. I really didn't enjoy this movie. There's a lot of things to admire about it. I love the lighting, like the old, how do you say, daguerreotype or like portraits, like the way the lighting is done. It makes them look like that portrait style from back then. I thought that was very well done. I thought some of the performances were great. I just...
Didn't work for you as a film.
No, I'll give you an example, right? I watched it with my girlfriend, with Gurbet, and she asked me why I didn't like it. And I told her, look, let me just replay every other scene in the movie. I'm angry about something. Emily Dickinson. You shouldn't be angry about this. Other person. Well, I'm going to say something extremely mean. Emily Dickinson. You are being horrible. Other person. You're right. I'm worthless as a person. Emily Dickinson. No, you're not. You're lovable. Other person. Oh, Vinny. Every other scene. It was so tedious to me in terms of character development and all that stuff. So maybe we need to unpack it a little bit, because yeah, what I've been doing is trying to, why does that trigger me so much? Like, this movie triggers me into dislike, even though that it's shot beautifully, there's great pacing, it's very atmospheric, there's a great mood in it. I think it sets mood really well. If anything, it sets mood really well.
Sets mood.
So I definitely want to unpack with you why I'm reacting to it this way.
Right, right. And I'm hearkening to my first time having watched it, where I really liked it the first time. Set the scene. I saw it in Queens at the Bay main movie studio, a studio that I had done, you know, some background work before, some acting work before, Silver Cup Studios. And it was kind of like a, I guess, a free ticket, where I had gotten to see it with a friend of mine. And after I saw the movie, I might have seen a Muppets exhibit right after. So perhaps I'm conflating the two, where
I would have loved a Muppet version of this movie.
Which of the Muppets would you have play Emily Dickinson of the main crop?
Based on what I just said, Sam the Eagle, obviously.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Now, the element that I'm not agreeing with you on is, I guess, the dialogue, the scenes, although contrived, it still played wittily enough to me, where the banter was entertaining, where it played like an Oscar Wilde kind of collection of quotes, where, okay, you know, she's in a scene, but then she has somewhat of a snarky, witty retort that was surprising to me, that the language bounced back and forth. And I, as much as the language, you know, kind of bounced back and forth, the thing that I'm only coming to now is, okay, if she was such a recluse, how in turn did she become such a sharp critique of society, and kind of like know how to respond to lots of these different circumstances? And the movie purports that she wasn't always that. She was kind of immersed in society, and she gradually became more of a recluse. I don't know if that plays to what her real personality was or not. I'm not sure.
It's interesting, right? Because, so I agree with you. I thought the dialogue was great. The performances didn't convince me. I thought the scenes were contrived. I didn't think that there was, like, a lot of things made sense. So for example, at the very beginning, young Emily is juxtaposed with her aunt, and she makes fun of her. She seems to have a dislike for her. But then when her aunt is leaving, she's like, but I love you. Another person leaves, another person's away. And I'm like, I just didn't get how she had this attachment to somebody she had showed, at least through the movie, disdain, right? So for me, there wasn't emotional connections that validated or explained or gave cause to her behavior. So why don't we take a step back, right? And start breaking down some themes. So as you said, she was known as a recluse. And I think one of the things that triggers me is she seems to make a lot of fear-based decisions, right? I told you, I was examining what about this triggers me. And I think the movie tries to play it both ways, and I don't think it can have it both ways. In one sense, her slowly abstaining from society is, or can be seen as, a rebellion of of societal norms that try to repress her because she's a woman and she's not allowed to write. At the end, there's a scene where she's arguing with her brother about the comparing a woman's role in society to slavery, which he takes offense to, and they have a big argument about that. But she seemed, you know, she stands by her convictions. She's also presented, but not shown to be somebody who is morally inflexible, right? So there's that. But to me, there's also this fear of death and this fear of attachment, because if you get attached, you lose something. So I'm just going to abstain from life so I don't lose anything. But she also says she's what she wants is truth, right? So to me, it was all of this. These things did not align for me to paint a portrait of the poet that I have admired. Yeah, because if you look at, like, for example, her use of em dashes, a revolutionary. She's like, I don't want semicolons. I don't want periods. I want this pause in this breath in this way, and I'm going to do it in my way. I'm going to capitalize all my nouns to give them more importance. She rebelled against the structures of grammar in that society in her form, the way she rebelled against what, like, society wanting her to get married, society wanting her to you know, be seen and not heard, not have her own opinions, etc. So you can see that. So I'm having trouble reconciling the rebellion versus fear-based decisions and trauma. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think we get some of those, to tackle your last point, we get some of that with Cynthia Nixon's performance. We get some of the grammatical tricks and some of that other stuff with how she is delivering. It's like a performance poem before performance poems were even a thing, of how they come out of her. And it feels connected to the page. That being said, from what I've read, a lot of Emily Dickinson's poems were not in her original voice that were originally published. They were edited by other publications to more fit her voice. And only recently now, I don't know what that period is of now, that it more reflects actually what she said. And then, you know, of course, we've got the factor of 10 poems or 8 poems that were only published while she was alive, and she's written over 1,800. I think we're seeing more of kind of, all right, the filmmaker, what he supposed that some of these poems, I guess, where they might have come from in her life. You said she seeks truth. And I don't think when we say she seeks truth, it's the same thing as her seeking honesty honesty. It's she wants...
I said she says she seeks truth. There was a disconnect for me there too.
So I think she seeks the authentic person around her, but she almost like she wants to be surrounded by interesting people, if that makes sense. Like she's bored by her mother. Like she actually like is, and she wants almost people that she disagrees with, or people that maybe run counterintuitive, because that fuels her, I guess, writerly nature. That if she's around that, that's where some of these other things are coming from. It's interesting. I know we might watch this, the Shakespeare's The Anonymous about Shakespeare, whether Shakespeare wrote the poems with which he did. Because, like, in order to tap into some of the things that a writer writes about, do they have to go through it? And we're not talking positive or negative, but do they have to experience it for themselves? Or do, like, where is she funneling these observations from at this time? She has her set of views, I guess, and then it is coming, you know, she's counterpointing, she's counterpointing. That's where it started. It loses me a little bit. Like, all right, had she lived enough life to be able to write these things before she became a recluse?
And
But yeah,
I agree
it's
with that.
interesting how we're totally it's I'm giving her more credit, or I'm giving the filmmakers more credit, I think, than it doesn't play from what I've read about Emily Dickinson necessarily, but that in turn still worked for me as a film.
So I agree with you in the sense that that's another disconnect for me. You know what I say. I'm like, whenever I'm on a podcast or whenever I'm talking about my book or whenever I'm talking about poetry or just us, you know, talking shop, I'm like, you need to go live life and experience so that you can grow your imagination and do it. If she's a recluse, how does she find that truth? But again, she became more and more of a recluse towards the end of her life. It seemed that she had a very rich imagination, at least in the way the filmmakers portray her, to the point where she, who judges others for lapses in morality, you know, falls in love with a married man who she just likes his sermons. And I think the reason she fell in love with the preacher was because he liked her poems. And she needs this validation. It's interesting. I never found her to be bored with her mother. I always thought she was looking for her approval, her love, her attention, because her mother suffered from depression. So I see this in her. And I know I was mocking those scenes, but she has this violent outburst, right? Because she's so frustrated with the way things are. Like, you can see she's a brilliant person, right? You can see she's funny, but society allows her no outlet for this. There's a scene in the movie where they say, oh, we can be here in the house or we can walk through our modest garden. And that's her world. Where can she engage in these conversations and allow her imagination, her wit to bloom and to connect with others? No, she just does it with her family. But it also seems she has a desperate need for approval, and she's looking for it anywhere. And when she gets it, she's like, oh, I love this person. And I don't know if it has any basis in reality.
Well, she had the one friend, right? Who's the one that got married first?
Oh, God, her name is Vryling exactly. Buffum, I think.
Right? Vryling, who felt Ms. like a compliment to her, they were totally in sync, and she almost, you know, upstages her, but then she, I guess, folds into societal norms by getting married, and then that was where some of her spirit started to leave. But she was introduced, you know, they were a duo together. That's where, like, the woman that the preacher is with at first too, that the tea scene where, I mean, she is completely bored by her. Like, it just feels like, like, because she doesn't go out and do all these, you know, I mean, that woman, yeah. And she plays.
I don't know if she's bored by her as much as she's offended by her, right? Like, she's
I guess I take it as bored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, she's like, oh, I abstain from this and tea. That. It's like, I thought it was only from alcohol. Well, like, no, tea as well. It's like, would you like lemonade? it was a very funny scene, right? But it has that same relationship she has with her aunt, I imagine, with this piety which she abhors, but then she is also inflexible in her judging. Now, I am no proponent of adultery, right, when she has the issues with her brother, but she can't, she seems to judge others extremely harshly because she lives in ideals, right? I should be this, I should be that. She lives, to me, she lives under the tyranny of should, which makes her incredibly unhappy. But I don't want to downplay the fact that she is enslaved by society to the point that even if she gets published, she doesn't have control of how it goes out to the world. Somebody will modify it and change her meaning, or at least she mentioned that it was as great a crime as anything else. Like, you're changing my meaning, you're changing my words, you're taking my identity. I finally get out there, and now you're manipulating it to be something that I am not, and I am tired of not being anything that I want to be.
I really love that scene of when the publisher comes to her house and, reminded me of a workshop, a poetry workshop sometimes of, when somebody's giving you a hard critique and, it's hard to even, how does one person know better than you when you've written it sometimes? It rang true of how, idealistic she, or how stalwart she is with her beliefs in that scene. It seems, I keep getting back that you're a little hung up on the contradiction of the brother having the affair, but her also going after the preacher.
The contradictory thing is she knows what it's like to desire a married person, right? And I can see her, but she didn't act on it. And I can see her judging her brother for acting on it, him being married to someone that she cares about with another married person, right? But he acts on it, and that's what she finds reprehensible. I found that she was envious. I find that her anger doesn't come from, I don't think she's in touch with what she truly feels. And when she does come close to it, she represses it, she bathes it in anger or something else. But I think she is, at least as she's presented in the film, a creature of envy, of her inability to do the things that she wants or express herself the way that she wants, maybe because she is a woman, right, in that society. But
able to express herself on the page. She's able to express herself within the poetry, but not act on it, I guess. She's not able to put it into action.
Right. But and her work is incredibly restrained and always full of metaphors. Her poems never yell. Her poems never scream. There's no emotional release in her poems. I mean, if you read through them, it's always very, it's under the surface, it's hinted at, it's there, but there's no pah, right? When we read our poems, I can go into some of that. I find her to be that way. Yes.
Well, how much was her? When she gives the poem to the preacher, I love that. I love that.
See, it was a good scene. It was a good scene.
Like, they're not spoon feeding you a little with it, and it can be interpreted in my mind a couple of ways. Like that's her kind of playing with religion. Like, all right, you're in this, but is this poem going to get a rise out of you? She's able, that's her expression she's giving to him rather than being able to ever say it or act on it. I mean, it is a bold move. Are we to say, though, that is the filmmaker saying some of her health problems that come is from that restrained passion? Like, the first time it happens, I wasn't sure what happened. Where she falls on the stairway, I couldn't tell if it was sexual or what. I didn't know if she just, like it was pain or pleasure when she first comes in and falls.
Was that before or after she yells at the family's help?
Oh.
Because she has that outburst, and that's eventually tied into her disease.
I thought it was right before. Do you remember there was kind of two times? And then, of course, there's a scene where she's visited by a figure in the shadows. And, that, I'm curious to your interpretation.
Oh, when she has the vision.
Whether that was... All right, that's her restrained passion of it's happening kind of like she wants to be taken by some mysterious figure in the night. Possibly, I don't know how much reading you did. There's some literature on that she actually had an affair with her brother's wife.
Right. I think they hinted at it.
Maybe I don't know. Like, maybe I wouldn't have thought that if I hadn't read it after. I just, because it's not gendered. It's not It's just a mysterious shadow.
So I thought it did, and it might be the baggage of Cynthia Nixon playing Miranda, who is, you know, who has romantic relationships with regardless of gender in Sex and the City. So maybe that carried over for me. But they have this very intimate conversation where the wife or her sister-in-law says, "I do my duty," right? When it comes to like, your brother is tender and he's sweet, but I do my duty. So there's no attraction from her to him. And she is confessing that to Emily. And I don't know, there seemed to be more of a tension for me in the way that they spoke than just friends or sister-in-law. And her anger at her brother for hurting his, or for, you know, sullying the relationship with this person, to me implied that maybe, I don't know if they had a relationship, but that she felt some sort of attraction or inspired some sort of passion in her, right? I think another person who inspired passion was Miss Buffin, but it was, I think that was more of an intellectual equal, like, you are what I can't be. You say the things out loud that I say writing it down, right? But when it's time to live it, you repress yourself and you go off and you say, like, no, I'm gonna submit to this because that's my lot in life. And that, and she rejects it. She's like, I will go to your wedding, but I won't wave goodbye. Let me know if she's okay, right? She has these moments of just push and pull and push and pull, which I think is reflected in the lighting, because you have, she's often half lit, right? Like a bathed in chiaroscuro, like a Rembrandt or something, right? Which equals that duality, which you also find in Emily's poems. I think the director, let me take a step back. So Cynthia Nixon is a scholar on Emily Dickinson, right? Which is one of the reasons the director, Terrence Davies, wanted her to play Emily. Terrence Davies is also a big fan of her. And I think that the way that he shot the movie is more true to Emily Dickinson's poems than what I found there. Like, I admire that. I found, like, those long pauses in between scenes reminded me of the M Dash, for example. It reminded me of the M Dash, for example. Some of the way that it was shot, some of the way that it was done reminds me more of her style of poetry. Also, do you remember the scene where the family ages and it's those funeral portraits?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's the first time they age from, there's a different actress playing
the children.
Emily
the
Dickinson.
Children.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
The Dickinson children are changing to the...
I thought that's brilliant. And it's...
That was really good.
It's pre-AI, I guess. Like, and it's a better way than AI. It reminded me of the Michael Jackson video.
Which is better than any AI, the black and white yeah, that we have now. That was peak. That was peak special effects.
Right. So there's a morphing, and it really, like, works that, all right, you're taking and you're finding similar features between those. And that's a testament, I guess, to the makeup department and I mean, some of its visual effects.
They do it at the end when you see the portrait of the death portrait again of Emily Dickinson, and it morphs into the actual portrait of Emily Dickinson. Right.
Right. There's a fun with playing with the duality too. After the mourning, they're all in black. She then, at that period, is when she commits to just wearing white. And it's like, all right, white is a symbol of purity, innocence, but it's also, he's still rebelling in some way of like, all right, we're all mourning, but I'm
going to wear
white from here.
I'm going to rebel in my way. I'm going to not align myself with what you expect of me. But I wanted to ask you something, because we've talked around it for a bit. Mm-hmm. Cynthia Nixon's delivery of Dickinson's poems, I found it to be flat but emotional, right? Like, again, a lot under the surface. It's very even in the way that she reads it, but a lot under the surface, which I think aligns with the style of her poetry. Mm-hmm. How do you think Cynthia Nixon's delivery, I mean, of the Dickinson poems, affect their emotional resonance?
it worked for me. It felt more authentic to the poet. I mean, it was some, I felt that this character wrote the pieces and then actually delivered it. Yes, there's no real bells or whistles, but sometimes, I don't know, did she talk directly to camera, or like it could play as interior monologue, even though they're being said out loud. So like that aspect, I appreciated. It felt organic to me. I was taken by them. They took you out a little bit, you're saying?
No, I found it to be, I think the flatness was good for me, right? I think it was flat, but filled with emotion, but she read it in a bit of a flat way. And I think that when juxtaposed with the highly emotional scenes they were being said over, the death of her father, for example, her funeral, they were incredibly effective, right? So for me, it worked. Those were probably my favorite parts of the movie.
Yeah.
But I just think it's interesting because are we being true to the story, or is the story being true to her in these things that recreate her form, her rebellion, her... I'm still trying to decide for myself what this film is trying to say. Like, is it a feminist film, right? Is it more radical and it's quiet than Louder biopics? Or biopics. I don't know yet. I'm sitting with it still. And whether I enjoyed it or not in that sense, it doesn't mean it's a bad movie. And I think the mark of a good movie is one that sits with you for a while. And this one's sitting with me for a while. I just have something in me that rejects some of it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I wrote a couple quotes down: pleasure first and then excuse from pain. I thought that was a theme that resonated throughout. There's the interplay too of death and immortality and all that. That's what a lot of her work tends to be. And it's kind of like, all right, we're watching the photographs, and like, photographs are something that's immortal as well. That they don't age, but we're watching them age. But you know, photographs at each time, photographs, I guess, live on forever. And yes, her poems do, as we know from to now, they have lived on and taken on a new life. What was another quote? Neither congenial nor trivial, living as a woman.
Hmm.
Give me something pressed from truth, and that is poetry. Yeah. All right. Yep. That's what you had. I wanted to ask you a couple questions too, that this kind of brought to mind. You know, your feelings. I thought we talked to this one on legacy, like, yes, you know, she wanted her poems to be around, but I don't know if she lived to them, many of them actually being published.
Most were posthumous.
But for you, does that weigh greater to have a body of work that has been appreciated in your lifetime versus having just created a body of work?
I'm not even there. What the movie represents is true, it makes me feel great sorrow for her, because she couldn't even enjoy the act of creation while she was alive.
Yes.
Right? So for me, do I want my work to live on after me? Of course. We've talked about the legacy, what's left for my family, even my ego, right? To be known as a great poet or as one of the greats. But if I'm not enjoying creation, then what am I doing? Right? Like, I she's miserable in life. She's thought of as miserable in death, or having suffered greatly in death. Like, if I could wish anything for her, it would be some release. And to answer your question, it's almost the way that I feel about poems, right? Like, once I write the poem, it's no longer mine. It belongs to the world. It belongs to whoever is reading it, because they're going to give any meaning tied to it. She wanted recognition in life. I don't know if this vindication after death is something that she would have felt good about. I'm sure she would have felt good about being recognized, but she would have wanted it to be done in life, I think. And for me, whether I'm recognized in life or death, I would want to enjoy the process of creation more than being recognized while I'm alive or being recognized while I'm dead, because
it doesn't matter to you once you're dead. Yeah. I mean, you don't get to see anybody enjoying the work or what they make of it.
Yeah. What about you, bud?
Yeah. I mean, previous to this, to having children, you know, those were my, you know, poems being my greatest creations, where anything that I put on a page, the process as well as the performance of them. And I guess I've learned to, you know, some poems that I've worked so long on to be performed just one time. And that is it. That moment was so incredible for me. I mean, I've delivered a poem at a funeral for a fraternity brother of mine that had passed away. And, you know, that in turn, being able to be there for those people that were grieving somebody that was not, that was a special, special moment. And I'm never, you know, performing that again, or people don't have to read that in another thing, but it was just for that one time being able to hear it. Now kind of having children, kind of with another on the way.
That's right. TikTok.
That turns the legacy thing a little bit differently, because the essence of me and my wonderful wife are in the child, so that they in turn can also, you know, echo us in their life and their children's lives, with just elements of, you know, their creations, their both artistic and life creations. So I still value both of them, you know, being able to create. And I share with you, you know, like, yeah, the process. You know how excited you are when you finish something, you know, you want to just, yeah.
Of course.
Who told me to, though, you know, after you write something, wait like a day before sharing it with a loved one that might have a critique that you're not ready to hear, or just that just exists with the joy you had with writing it. And then, all right, you got to edit it and that sort of stuff. Maybe give it a day. So yeah, I legacy. The other question I wanted to ask you too, if you don't mind, is at what point I want us to find at time, what is it that we love about Emily and what do we recognize in ourselves about Emily? At what, can you share a time in your life when you became maybe a recluse? Was there a period for you of social isolation, and what brought about that? And was that a boon to your creativity, or was that a inhibitor?
Well, when I was in my early 30s and I was starting my career, I made the mistake of dating somebody I worked with, and she was 11 years older. And, you know, I don't want to go into details, let's just say I wasn't the only one in the picture. So the way that it went down and how it went down and the other person was at that job who had a position of power over me, I didn't really date anybody for 3 years after that. I isolated my, I thought I was angry at her, and then I thought I was angry at women, and it ended up being that I was just angry at myself. And I isolated myself by not dating anybody for about 3 years, almost 3 years, which is an extremely long time. And all that did was just prevent me from connecting with other people. So it definitely felt Dickinson-like.
Now, were you creating through that process, or did it shut you down? And you said you withdrew, it shut you down, and you withdrew from dating, but was this from male friendships as well? Was this from just
from being vulnerable,
even to,
from being vulnerable in a romantic sense? Yeah, just that
in a romantic sense.
Yeah, because it's in the romantic sense and also in the friendship sense, because it's like, you know, I shared myself with someone and it was just not the situation I should have been in. And instead of me, you know, taking ownership for the part that I played and accepting that I'm not perfect and accepting that things, you know, don't always go that the way that they quote unquote should, you know, I lived under the tyranny of should. I just said, well, I'm just going to abstain. I went from one end of the spectrum to the other. And the abstention is, well, if you don't, if you're not in the game, you're not going to get hurt. But if you're not in the game, you're not going to play. You're not going to live. You're not going to experience. And 3 years of somebody's life is a long time. It's a long time to be afraid to make mistakes.
Yeah. Right on.
Maybe that's why this triggers me now that I think about it.
Well, that's what I'm trying to think of it. And did you pull yourself from that? Was there another individual, or was there art?
I think it was just, I did a lot of work. I remember one of the things that really helped me pull out of it was Ho'oponopono, the Hawaiian thought process of just taking accountability. Like, you know, I caused, this is what I caused. If I caused it, I forgive myself. I can also, by taking accountability, I know that I'm no longer a victim, because if I helped cause this, that means I can stop doing the behavior that led to it. And I have agency over how I act moving forward. It doesn't happen to me. I played a part in it. So then I can move on and move forward. So that's one of the ways that it went through. And then, I mean, poetry is always there, right? Like, there's always the Nerudas, which make it seem really cool to be in love again, right?
Right.
But art played a part, but I really did some introspection and realized, you know, what part did I play in this situation? Why am I so angry? And at the end of the day, it wasn't that I was angry at her. I wasn't angry at women. I wasn't angry. I was angry at myself, because I should have been better in my head right at that point. I should have been more intelligent. I should have been this. I should have been that. When in reality, it's, yeah, was I intelligent enough to see that something wasn't kosher? Sure. But for some reason, I chose to ignore that. And that's okay. It's what I needed at the time. So in that sense, I think there is definitely a parallel with the character of Dickinson in this movie. She just never got to that realization point, I don't believe.
Yeah. And it came in as illness.
And I feel like the illness was internalized. Like, it's that even when she was gasping in pain, it was it wasn't a yell. It wasn't a scream. It wasn't. It was these shakes. It was very self-contained. Mm-hmm. You know, contained inside. And I'm not saying they're saying exactly this, but there's a suggestion that keeping things within will overwhelm you, you'll act. And I believe this. Like, when I was going through my father's, through grieving my father's death, I was moving too fast to grieve, and I developed acne, which I never even had going through puberty. I started having breathing issues. I started having heart rate issues where I've never been sick and I haven't been sick since. So if I think withholding and having no release, maybe not literally, but maybe so, will eventually kill you. You have to let some of that pressure go, whether through creation or not. Maybe her poems were the way for her to, even though they were very restrained, maybe that was her way of letting go, right? And maybe her becoming a recluse wasn't madness. It was a way to have space for creation.
Well, that too. Yeah. I mean, that is how she kept, yeah, quietly passionate. I mean, you're pouring it, you're writing it onto a page. You're writing about screaming and expressing passion. And then one other question too, you know, the quiet passion I'm thinking of, is there, you know, obviously for us poetry, what would you akin as another one of your quiet passions or a passion of yours that might not have had a chance to manifest, that there's something else that you also have within you that hasn't fully been able, you know, to fully come out?
You mean like my competitive ballroom dancing career?
Perhaps.
I don't know, because if there's one thing that I've learned through my father's death, through all of, you know, what we just discussed and some other things as well, is if I'm passionate about something, I'm not quiet about it. I go into it. I don't think there's anything. I'm not loud. I don't go like, argh! But if I love something, I proclaim it.
And you'll. Nice. Yeah.
I mean, look behind me. That's a WWE title, my friend. Those are James Bond Funko Pops, right? I'm a huge Disney adult. None of these things, Broadway guy, like none of these things I keep quiet about. Because I love sharing what makes me happy with others that would enjoy it as well.
Yeah, I guess, you know, like the only thing that comes to mind for me is singing, in that when I was 13, I was doing my bar mitzvah hop tour portion, and like my mom's like, oh, wow, isn't he pretty good? And you know, I was very theatrical with it. I was delivering with all this, and it wasn't necessarily on key. And the cantor was like, oh, and my mom was like, oh, should we put him in some singing lessons? And the cantor was like, no, I don't think you should, because his voice is going to change in a year or two, and it's going to change the range or whatever.
That's so much BS. You would have learned breath control. You would have learned technique.
Right. So like that one thing. And yes, I didn't go through the formal training of singing, but that in turn fueled my poetry so much, of like finding my own rhythms but now test, like I bust out into song. I'm not even afraid to bust out in song, even though it's not totally correct. So I've shift the fear. I just don't have the skill set of having perfected that. It's almost like hip hop, like in rap. Like, okay, if I were to lean into, you know, being a full fledged hip hop artist, like I would have to stay on beat a little more, and I can write to that, but there's something about how I write, or something about the writing that I like, that goes off on tangents, that doesn't have to always fit into the bar structure. And there are hip hop artists that do it, you know. But yeah, I'm comfortable now with not having music necessarily in the background. But yeah, for me, singing.
I don't know, dude. Yeah. I've shared some car rides with you in Telluride. I know that you bust out into song. You know that I bust out into song.
I bust. I'm just saying that was a passion that, okay, you know, if I had had those lessons early on, could have changed trajectory in some respects.
True.
No regrets.
I do think it's interesting, though, that you know that I can be a classicist, right? And you know that right now I'm very preoccupied with finding different poetic forms and adhering strictly to its structure, but with contemporary language and contemporary things. And sometimes when you are a master of the structure and a master of the technique, you break it for emotional resonance. And what you're describing seems to me that, right? I'm not assuming you're a master, and you're not, I don't say you're claiming to be a master, but I think you know enough about something to be able to play around with it. And you always love playing around. I like to follow the foundational stuff and be really rigid about it so I can achieve transcendence and surpass it. You love to play around within it, push it. You like to push those boundaries. I mean, at least that's what I see, right? So I don't see that as different.
Yeah. No.
Quietly, yeah. Passionately.
Quietly, passionately. I used to, you know, one of my favorite vocab words was vehemence.
Oh, really?
You know what vehement, when I learned it in, I think, seventh grade, we had vocab checks.
And you wanted to vehemently do that.
Vehement. But yeah, I guess it's a negative connotation. But because I always heard it, what did you hear it described as? I heard it as violently passionate. Vehement being violently passionate is how I described that.
But like, yeah, no, I've heard it that way. I've heard it that way, but I also have heard it in the sense of enthusiasm. I've also heard like just passionate, like passionately.
It is passionate, but I've heard the violent before that. But yeah, it is. Can vehemence be positive?
Why can't it be? Why does violence? So you and I have discussed this before. Like I think we're passionate. I think we're in a culture that commodifies emotion and has industries around how to overcome negative emotions. Anger is negative. Jealousy is negative. But I do think that we need to feel all of our emotions because they each have a purpose. Like guilt leads to redemption, right? Like if you don't feel guilty, like feeling guilty sucks. But if you feel guilty, then that could lead to a redemption, right? So I think we need to go through all of these processes. They're all part of a spectrum. And to ignore the spectrum, to not even be able to live in it, doesn't allow us to live in this world, because we will have times when we're angry. We will have times when we're guilty. Like anger leads to release. Sometimes you need to be like, ah, right? And that's okay.
And like you can be vehemently opposed to an unjust practice, and which may lead to positivity. All right. So quiet passion. yeah, we're somewhat split. Didn't connect with you as much as some of the earlier things that we've watched. Can we do a quick comparison to Dead Poets Society? Are we feeling like this we have the opening scene, of course, of this repressive atmosphere and some of her poetry, I guess, coming out of that. It's critique on religion. Classism. I guess she lived meagerly. What was her view of I guess like capitalistic values, Emily Dickinson?
She was always reminded that she should be grateful for the place she has in society, right? That's a theme in the movie, with her being dissatisfied. So I don't know, but when it comes to Dead Poets Society, I keep coming to artistic rebellion versus societal conformity, right? Just the creation, for example, of the Dead Poets Society as a way to rebel against what the societal norms that they had. Yeah. And you have at the beginning a young Emily at a Mount Holyoke Seminary. You know, her school, arguing with her headmistress when being asked to accept Christ, right?
Yeah.
And she remained seated. And I remember her saying something akin to, I wish I could feel as others do, but I cannot, right? Like, I won't lie to myself to make you feel better. I won't lie to make anybody else feel better. I do not feel as you do. Would it be easier for me? Yes. Would I be happier? Yes. But I do not feel that, so I'm going to be honest. And that is very akin to the Dead Poets Society, the boys in the Dead Poets Society rebelling to do it. At the end, they end up conforming, but they have that last poetic act, right? When they say goodbye to their captain and acknowledge their captain. Robin Williams' character, I forgot the name of the teacher, Mr.
Keating.
Mr. Keating. Yeah.
Yes. But yeah. Yeah. But there's no Emily Dickinson.
And she should be. I mean, it's funny because maybe she should. Wouldn't she have been taught alongside, you know, Whitman and everybody else based on the time period?
Well, Bronte, she kept quoting and.
Well, she was Civil War era, right? She was Civil War era.
Browning and Bronte.
Yeah.
My computer froze.
Yeah. And when it comes to her refusal to publicly conform to church, to marriage, to publishing, right? And that's an interesting question that I have for you in a second. But I also think that mirrors her poetic innovations, right? Like the capitalization of nouns, seemingly random to give them importance, right? Like we already talked about the M dashes and stuff like that. I think it's interesting how they use that to mirror her poetry feeds her rebellion and her rebellion. Like maybe her poetry is a manifestation of that rebellion, right? And maybe that's why she was revolutionary in that sense. And when it comes to Dead Poets Society, it's funny because we didn't really see them create other than the scene with Ethan Hawke. Yeah, like that was a moment of creation that, and we see her writing a lot in this movie, as you said. I think the Dead Poets Society was people who appreciate poets or poetry. And the Emily Dickinson, A Quiet Passion, deals with somebody who creates poetry. It's a little different, right?
Yeah, her contemporaries were authors sometimes more than, or playwrights maybe, or authors more than other poets too.
Yeah.
I thought.
Here's the question I wanted to ask you, because I know we're about to run out of time. What does the film suggest about publishing? Is it validation or is it betrayal?
I mean, from the one interaction that she had with the publisher, it would seem that the right publisher is validating, but the someone that does not align with, you know, the kind of the partner that says what you want them to say rather than what they're really feeling sometimes, or what you want to hear rather, can be destructive. Perhaps she that would have been a role for her of validating other poets down the line. She becomes a Florana and publishes other poets in addition.
She was a harsh critic of other poets throughout this movie too. So,
but everyone that is up to her standard. How about for you?
I think the movie I don't think the movie clearly defines where it lands. I think it presents both cases, right? Like her being published allows us to know who she was years later, allows us to know that she was revolutionary for her time, and that she has an impact on generations of poets that came after her, right? If she wasn't published, that wouldn't happen. But her being published while she was alive, in the manner that she was published, with a male editor who thought, I know better than this woman, she felt betrayed. So I think the film presents both, but it's just interesting, right? I think maybe we take for granted what publishing is for us now versus what it was for somebody back then.
Oh yeah, very true. Yeah, I mean, post something on Instagram, it's published on Facebook too.
Yeah, and if let's say, like, for example, you submit to the New Yorker and you decided to post that poem before they review it on your Instagram, oh, it's published, peace out. It's already been published, it's out of contention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, is the validation of 1,000 likes more rewarding than it appearing in a periodical that has a small, a reputable one with a relatively shrinking readership?
Readership, yeah. Yeah, who knows? I mean, that's the other thing. And we've talked about it before, our delivery mechanisms are constantly evolving. The way that these poems got to people are way different than the way our poems get to people, which are way different than a generation after us are getting to people. You know,
I think Emily Dickinson would have came to the Poetry Slam, to even the Dead Poets Society, and that might have gotten her out of the funk. A couple more, not necessarily like-minded individuals, but fellow appreciators of the written word would have had a healing effect for her.
She was just so isolated, right? And she was isolated because it was very rare for her to find somebody who could understand the way her mind worked other than her sister, and could be there and inspire creativity. But she isolated, like society isolated her, but then she isolated herself and denied herself. Like there was the scene with the suitor who came and she was rude to him and he left. And she said, like, why did you do? She's like, I don't know. I don't know why I do these things. I feel they're getting close and then I push them away so they can't leave, but they leave anyway. Right. And that, it makes me feel, I felt an immense amount of pity, but I also, I'm like, you're doing this to yourself. It's a guy that, yeah, he's younger, but he's not there because he's there because he admires your poetry. That's stated in the movie. They make it very clear. He's a great admirer of your work. He wants to get to know you more. He admires you. It's what she wanted, and she can't deal with it.
We wrote a few verses about this. I dug up my piece from the first time that I saw it. I found it.
Okay.
That I was going to try. I mean, it's, would you like to go first, or would you like me to go first?
No, I'd love to. I want to hear yours.
All right. Yeah, let me go first. Actually, the following poem was written by my reclusive alter ego, a far more gregarious poet named Greg. Yeah, let's call him Greg.
So your rap name is Scott and your alter ego is Greg?
Oh, this is, I guess, I don't know if it's, yeah, it's my alter ego. Let's call him Greg. Okay, so again, Greg wrote this. I'm reading it for the first time. This poet has noticed he's growing less and less focused. One minute he's upside down sideways, the next he's in lotus. He stands, he sits, he clacks, he clicks. He uploads, downloads, then changes his profile pics. 22 jumping jacks, 30-second planks, updating his codex. That and the OCD arranging of a few rows of his bics. This is only aerobics. Let's face it, but don't face him. He's becoming agoraphobic. To be clear, that's agoraphobic, not agoraphobic, as in the irrational fear of vice presidents named Al. Although, the inconvenient truth of it all is this. This slouch really has no clue what's going on with climate change because he rarely leaves the couch. So as his condition continues to worsen, he's taken to speaking almost entirely in third person. Because, having avoided doctors, refused help, he finds it difficult even dealing with himself. As it stands, he sits, he clacks, he clicks. And if any clubs, cafes, or coffee houses are shutting down, he wouldn't know. But who cares? There's no place like Homebody. He's his own one-man show. Oh, how Brechtian. Why even try to compete when he already expects to win? His friends, family, and all his would-be fans are waiting outside for him, but he won't let this audience in. On the bright side, the longer he stays boarded up in his apartment without shaving or showering, the less susceptible and less desirable he becomes to sex offenders. What? I'm just reading this. It's not like he's really a target for this, and no one should ever go through life expecting to be considered a subject. Greg realizes he should have edited some, out of respect. But Greg needed an excuse to try out his theories on the alienation versus predator effect. Not to be confused with the Aryan Nation effect, which states self-imposed isolation, limiting physical interaction with people of color, inaccurately convinces a white individual of his dominance and superiority over another race, regardless of his exposure to BET programming, the History Channel, and most Tyler Perry movies. Greg digresses. The longest conversations he had had all day are also his shortest, both with delivery men from two separate eateries and both appropriately named Phil. Five or six words and that was that. There was, there's good, and leave it on the welcome mat. A Cobb salad and a turkey border arranged, both meals ordered in no time, online seamlessly, no money or eye contact exchanged. He takes care of his needs with ease, but is crippled by ego and pride. Even the angel on his shoulder keeps screaming, take a goddamn walk. Go the fuck outside. His subconscious used to be his hero, but now it's a half-eaten sandwich on rye. It's not that he's socially awkward, he just feels socially superior sometimes, given all that he's seen. In this state, his ex-wife had a better chance at getting through to him through YouTube vids and internet memes, as he binge-watches four episodes at once on two separate screens. He draws inspiration from animation, speaks in emoticons, and thinks he can control temperatures via TV stations. ABC means it's a bit cold. NBC pleads, needs better clothes, while CBS seems to be showing could be snow, so when reaching CW, he closes windows. He's starting to realize that nothing rhymes with orange is the new black, so he watches the Knicks, then eats a few knickknacks, lies down to watch True Detective while hooked to a polygraph. But he's all out of leftovers, and Breaking Bad's not coming back. Sleep No More is now sleeps too much. Used to be groundbreaking theater and gut-punching stand-up. There'd be flirting with video store clerks, endless improv jams, checking out checkout girls and using a phone to place calls and make plans. He'd actually go and see his favorite bands and attend live prize-winning poetry slams to get his fix. Now all it takes is a pirated copy of Pirates of the Caribbean movies and endless streams of Netflix. No longer craving attention, he consumes more than he produces. But with all this variety, his true aesthetic gets diluted. Spotlights out. Center stage is his easy chair, and he sits in the dark. Cut the crap. Crosstown, someone shits, and it's art. Flip that handicap backwards to parallel park. Between work hard and work harder, hell, even if no one hears any of this, not one letter, he believes writing it has made him feel better. And that only in Scott. Hey, that's me. Sharing it with strangers, he achieves balance. So if you're gifted in lifting spirits, try and stop robbing the world of your talents. So let's not be strangers after this poem. Every day and night, he chooses to stay home. It isn't always the venue's fault for ending an open mic or closing its doors. It's your own. Uncap your next penaissance. Your work's worth a rebirth. Because if you don't want any more doors to close, you need to open yours first.
What about this movie
led you to that role?
Me exploring what my antithesis would be if I never left the house. If I was shut up, but in a modern sense, in a modern kind of sensibility. And now, like, it's something that I want to explore a little further with current conditions of, what a reclusive would be, you know, like. But that main point that we talked about at the beginning too, of like, if you're not out there exposed to the stuff, what are you drawing for from your writing too? And it is just media sometimes. But you need to have a little bit balance of those both. But I will say, you know, the part of me, it's an alter ego, but there is a part of me that becomes, if I have shut in, and it's, you know, it brings to mind the difference between solitude and loneliness, right? Like, I enjoy my solitude. I do. And there came a point when, like, I'd be left alone. And once I had my body of work, what do I do when I'm completely alone and I don't have anything? What did I used to do is I used to just go over my poems and say them out loud wherever I was. Say I didn't have a book, I didn't have a phone, I didn't have anything. I would go and I just perform them wherever I was. I remember my brother leaving me at like a train station once, and like he just drove away. And like, he's like, I'm not picking you up for another, you know, hour or something. I didn't know how I was going to get home, but just kind of went over my poems. I was like, all right, I'm okay. I have these right here with me. So that came out. Greg, I don't know where the name Greg came out. Plus, I just like the joke of being agoraphobic and alienation versus predator, some sort.
Yeah, I enjoyed that one, yeah.
Some sort of making those work. The idea. I'm a big fan of Brecht as a, you know, he's surrealist degree, but can you enjoy a show that's purposely created for you not to enjoy it? Like, or yeah. Can you enjoy something that's it's fighting against all impulses for what they know you're going to be able to follow and even enjoy, I'd say. Were you a fan? You know Bertolt Brecht and any of his work in theater and stuff? I mean, Job, the Irresistible Rise of Arturo Uy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I get that.
Are you able to enjoy that stuff, or do you check out from it? Like even a Twin Peaks too, like some people, because they can't follow a linear plot line and it's meant to kind of like alienate the viewer, they don't have a way in.
It's kind of how I felt with this movie. I recently rewatched Mulholland Drive, and it's more linear than Twin Peaks, I think.
Benches. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that I can find a way. Like, for example, even with this movie that I had trouble tying into the characters, I fell into the lighting, I fell into the dialogue, I fell into this, and I found a way to enjoy it, right? But it was more of a, it wasn't just the thing that I received. I had to actively search for it. And then I actually actively had to figure out what about it was making me reject some of this movie, right? Like, I, much like Emily mirroring her, I wish I could see the movie like you did, Scott. I really do. But I didn't, even though I do feel like I enjoyed parts of it and that I took a lot from it. You know, for my piece, you were over a couple of last week, a few days ago, or at the beginning of last week before the holiday, and we were talking about writing a piece based on what happens when the words get stuck in your throat, or what happens when you're not able to express yourself, like a balloon getting filled up until it pops, right? So I had that on my mind. I had that on my mind. And then when I saw this movie, that did resonate with me. So I'm going to read my piece, and then I'm going to walk you through why I did it. Not what the poem means, but why I did it, right? Okay. So this one is called "The Words Remained and Jammed Within, After a Quiet Passion," in the style of Emily Dickinson.
ED.
The words remain and jammed within, the syllables lie mute. A sinner's prayer dies entombed on silken parachutes. A kidney fails its mother's womb, the bile congeals inside. Our angry reprimands implode, the silence deafens heart. Our father's piety has failed to render moral fines, dismember limbs across facades once built and now collapsed. The air, once bright with sun and lights, a life to give away, gave all it had enclosed to give a suffocated blight. O moon, O stars, O nightingale, who sings without remorse, my envy stabs and rips your breast to take the soul from you.
There's some vehemence in there.
There's some vehemence. And you know, what I was trying to do was, I told you I felt a great amount of pity for the character of Emily Dickinson in this movie. And I wanted to give her release. I wanted to give her a chance to yell what she couldn't. So I kept her architecture and I distorted it, right? The quatrains, the M dashes, the capitalization of abstract nouns, compressed lyric voice, maybe a first person speaker reflecting on morality and silence and soul, right? But her metrical exactitude, I purposefully made it looser because I wanted to use form for structure and not constraint, right? I wanted to start untying it a little bit there. I also think, and this is opinion, I think my capitalization, which you can't see hearing the poem, is a bit louder. Dickinson used to use capitalization to elevate meaning. I wanted to weaponize it, right? I wanted to attack with it. And while she flirted with uncertainty, I imposed rupture. I wanted to break open what hers held in tension, right? So I also wanted to translate her inner suffering into outer violence, right? She often had her poems end in ambiguity and slippage and maybe an interior revelation, right? That's what she did. If you guys are familiar with her poem, I wanted to reverse that. The first couple of stanzas mirror that, but the fifth stanza, it turns sharply. There's no irony in it. There's no decorum. Right? There's no celestial infinitesses, right? It's just, and stab and a knife, right? I wanted to give her repressed grief a final gesture of agency, even if it was brutal, right? The theology's there, right? Maybe the difference is that while Dickinson questioned God in private in this poem, I wanted to drag God's failures into the light. Again, just trying to give her that release, complicate her obsession with death. But I wanted to give her a voice. I wanted to snap the ties of her restraint, and I wanted to let rage and envy, right? I told you that I thought she was envious. Enter that cathedral and give her a voice that screams and severs and survives even envy, even violence. So Yeah, that's how it inspired me, right?
I keep going back to her name, her initials, ED. Appropriate, isn't it? Yep, where just, you know, can't sustain, the desire might be there, but it's the release isn't even happening.
Yeah, man. I mean, I might be fooling myself with this one, but I wanted to let her speak through me and then say what she never could, you know, like that's what I wanted, because as I mentioned to you, that's the gift that I would give her. I'm like, just say what you mean to say, just live life out loud. Right. Maybe that's not what she wanted to do, but
God, she's saying some, but she's not acting on it. I think she's saying, she's not doing, in all the respect. I find her to.
But even when she says, as I mentioned, like, I mean, I've read enough of her poems. I know you have as well. It's always whispered, right? It's, she doesn't have that that the dialogue suggests in her written work, right?
Right. I also, to your point with how you the capitals, I'd love to see some of her original written stuff next to how it was published, and just to be able to compare what
I did some research on that. I got to see. Yeah, maybe I'll send you the link. I had the
posted in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll post it in the show notes. Oh God, what's that poem? Although I would not stop for death. I did look that one up and saw the capitalization, so I will send that over. But anyway, yeah, that's what I did.
Now, have you seen a recording too, though, like a more passionate delivery of some of her poems, of people that have been able to exhume?
No.
Or
have you?
Like,
is it in the show notes?
Right, right. No, I mean, I'm trying to harken back to a clip from the movie of her. Yeah, I'm trying to think of a good visual metaphor of, like, it's like arousal without orgasm. But it is still arousal. So it's, I don't know, is it metaphor play instead of release, her work, which I guess to me can still be satisfying?
So again, I don't have an issue with her work. I think her work is great. It's when I saw the movie, I felt like the character needed a release. Yeah. So it's definitely inspired by the movie. And then I have my own things in there and reasons I wanted to write it. And like maybe, you know, like the envy that she had in the movie made me think of like, yeah, if I can get my words out and I see somebody who is incredibly eloquent and can convey their meaning, I know I'd be jealous too, right? And how would I deal with that? Would it be in a violent outburst? Could I rationalize it? Could I just live in that jealousy for a second? You know?
You know what I was thinking of? A good part to this is, while we are on recording, we call up the person that we might have watched the movie with, and then without even telling them, what are your rememberings of the time that you saw this, to see what, even if it was years ago, what they've retained from having seen that movie.
I think Urbet would say, I remember you looking annoyed.
Right.
she called me out on that.
Of the experience, or yeah,
just like looking at her, because the thing is, I can definitely be an active movie watcher, and when the scene that I described plays out again, I'm like, oh look, another scene where she where she's like, oh, I'm unlovable. You're very lovable. Okay. Like, it's just, I definitely called it out like by the fourth or fifth time for sure.
Right. Because, but how, that can change your taking in of the movie too.
Yeah.
Where you're playing to the person you're with somewhat too. You know, there's movies that, all right, it becomes like a clowning with the person that you're watching it with.
I can see that.
Had you watched it alone, sometimes it takes on a different feel, or, you know, for better or for worse.
I can promise you, I'm that like Leonardo DiCaprio meme from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where he's like this. Like, I'm that watching movies by myself. I'm like, ah. Like, it's, I definitely do that. But I do think there's an aspect, because we were watching a movie together, then inside jokes develop, right? Which impact the viewing of the movie.
There was some stubbornness that I had growing up of, I didn't want to see Titanic. I refused to see it.
So good.
I refused to see it because it was so good. And I don't know why, but, well, I know why. I was a film snob, and I was like, I don't,
because Tomorrow Never Dies was out at the same time in theaters, baby. Right.
And that's
why.
I had this this notion in my head that I don't want to see the same movie that everybody on earth has seen, as if not to taint my aesthetic, where I recognize, I'm sure it's good. I'm sure it's a great movie that in the people will love it. But it was a pivotal point for me that I wanted to see only groundbreaking kind of indie type movies. And it was a badge of honor that I refused to see Titanic, even though it probably is great. I didn't want my like reference bank to be fueled with that. And there's an argument like, all right, that makes you more accessible because you're able to reference something that so many people have seen. But at the time, I had refused. You had another one, something that you didn't see that most people have seen, or anything that like collectively something, has been appreciated.
I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's one. Well, this has been Real Poets with me, Renzo del Castillo. And as always, I was joined by the man, the myth, the raven, Scott.
That's right.
I love it.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.